Merkel Media.
This was all circulating around the base that a giant had been killed, but no one was supposed to talk about it.
I saw three long bony fingers reach up underneath the door, curl up to grab it, and then disappear.
When he came over to me, dude, he slithered over to me.
And this giant comes out of the cave and they're all frozen. And he starts running and firing at this giant. Well, the giant moves. He's got a spear in one hand and he's running really fast and spears Dan and holds him up like this. Somebody yells, shoot him in the face, shoot him in the face. They basically decapitate him.
Got closer. When he got about 15 yards away from me, I raised that 12 gauge and I blow this head off.
I feel something pulling at my leg, and I look over and there are two small gray entities pulling at me. And they're literally, I'm getting pulled off the bed.
I reach my hand into this bush and I touch air. Couldn't breathe and I couldn't move because I know I'm seeing a monster.
Welcome to the show, everybody. You're listening to the Confessionals Podcast. I'm your host, Tony Merkel. Thanks for being here. If you have a crazy, wild experience you want to share with me on the show, go ahead and shoot me an email. My email address is contact@theconfessionalspodcast.com. That's contact@theconfessionalspodcast.com. Or go to the website, theconfessionalspodcast.com, hit the contact section, and you can reach me that way as well. Either works for me, just get a hold of me. If you want more shows on a weekly basis, we got you covered through memberships on the website and on YouTube for your convenience. So if you just want to consume the stuff on YouTube, just go to the YouTube join button and become a member. You'll get access to all the extra episodes right there on YouTube and, of course, on the website as well through our own members app. So if that interests you, go ahead and check it out to become a member today. Also, friends, go ahead and check out MerkMerch.com. I'm wearing our newest t-shirt right now, The Mothman. You can get that right now at MerkMerch.com. And check out MerkelFilms.com for all your documentary needs that we've put out, including the most recent, Sasquatch and the Missing Man. Before I get too far into this, I want to let you guys know, thank you very much. We have crossed 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and we just got our plaque in here in the mail. Let me hold it up here so the camera can see it better. Right there's the plaque. We're going to be putting it on the Studio B wall because we're remodeling it right now. That's why I'm doing the intro over here. So next time you see me, hopefully, I'll be in Studio B with a nice pretty wall behind me and all that good stuff. So listen, friends, today we have Paul Stobbs coming on, and he wrote a book called The Nephilim Look Like Clowns. It was the first time I ever heard of this. I had him on. It was a fantastic conversation. We're going to bring him back again for more information because we just scratched the surface on this. I know this is going to blow your minds. So let's get to it. All right. Today we have Paul Stobbs on the show coming from the UK. How are you, man?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Man, I'm glad you're here. So where in the UK are you at, roughly?
Roughly, the thing about the UK is I could name a random town and no one will have a clue where I'm talking about. It's probably best I just say something like near Manchester.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. that probably makes a lot more sense to people. Sure. I'm in the northwest in Lancashire. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. I know we have listeners in the UK for sure. I mean, the one guy, Luke, he's been a listener of my show from pretty much day one. And it's just, I don't always get to connect with people in the UK. And I just found out about you this past weekend. This is one of the most quickest turnarounds of an interview that I've ever been able to pull off. So I'm excited to talk to you. I think I first saw you on Tinfoil Hat Podcast. Were you on that podcast?
Yeah, it was Sam. Yeah,
that was. That's what I thought. I saw he came out with a podcast, and I'm pretty sure it was something Nephilim, and I recognized the face, and it's one of those things where you mean to click on it later and you never get around to clicking on it. And then last week I saw Vicky Joy Anderson post a picture of your book that she had gotten, and then, ironically enough, I believe it was Joel, my social media manager, who brought you up. And I looked at you, I was like, man, I gotta talk to this guy. And so here we are. I didn't expect to be talking to you so quickly, but thanks for coming on the show, man.
No, I mean, it's actually quite serendipitous that this happened so fast, because I actually had probably Alexandra booked for Wednesday on my own podcast. You know, she's been in the game for years and everything. And she, last minute, she had to cancel because of a family emergency. And then the next day, you messaged me saying, oh, I want you on the podcast. And you know what? Wednesday has just opened up, and I can only do Wednesdays and Sunday evenings, you know, and I'm booked up until like the end of August now for every Wednesday and Sunday. So you've kind of actually, this just worked out perfectly.
It's perfect. You know, I think that's what it was too, because you said that. That's what you said. I Wednesday just opened up and I'm booked up through August. And I was like, dang it, that sounds like me. Let me just get on this guy now. Let me get on it now while it's hot.
Yeah.
So here we are. So listen, man, I ordered your book and it just came today, and emergency happened at the house and I had to come in here to do the interview. I was planning on doing the interview at the house. But you know, it turns out my family wasn't leaving, and so I had to come in here, and works out best for, you know, the show, I'd say, but I forgot the book at the house. I really wanted to have the book to hold up and say to the people, see, I have it too. But you wrote a book called The Nephilim Looked Like Clowns, right? Or They Look Like Clowns.
Yeah, the Nephilim Looked Like Clowns. That's right. The book is actually coming at the end of 8 years worth of research. I started a series in 2016 on YouTube called The Nephilim Look Like Clowns. And we'll get into the story of how that happened as we go on. But over those 8 years, I've created a 44 episode video series dedicated to fleshing out this idea. And if I was to give you the quick elevator pitch now for what it is, it's that what we call a clown from a Western standpoint is actually a cult symbol purposefully crafted to be a caricature of the Nephilim and Nephilim features, and it's used specifically as a tool within the occult to channel the spirits of the Nephilim. And this is actually the same practice which is used by ancestor spirit worship cultures found all over the earth, who also dress in extremely similar features to what we would call clownish here in the West. But when they wear that costume, they are wearing it with the full intention to channel the spirits of what they call their ancestors. But they're not talking about grandma or granddad. They're talking about the builders of their civilization, the ancient Nephilim kings and rulers of the antediluvian past. And basically what seems to have happened is inspiration's been taken from these other cultures and representations of the Nephilim within other cultures, which again we'll get into. And Freemasons, quite literally, and the Shriners have invented what we call a clown. And we're not supposed to know what this really means. It's an occult symbol. And this is certainly no laughing matter, which is the tagline of my book. this goes way darker and deeper than you would like to think on the surface. I know what it sounds like when I say the Nephilim look like clowns. I'm not insane, but you'll realize this is actually a lot more serious than it sounds. Yeah.
No, I listen. Anytime we're talking about the Nephilim, you have my ears and attention, and. So the Nephilim look like clowns. You kind of just dumped a loaded chamber on us here, and I'm very interested into getting into this. But some of the things you just said, I find pretty interesting, because it seems like you're suggesting that one, like when we see in Hollywood, which I'm assuming you probably looked at Hollywood at some point through this research. But when you see movies in Hollywood, you see the like more occulty scenes in movies. They often wear masks and during rituals, assuming there's a connection there. I never heard that the Freemasons invented clowns. And so it seems like a lot of this, what your research has led you to, is that this is not random, because I sat down today thinking that you stumbled across this and it just so happens that the Nephilim look like clowns. But what you're saying is they created clowns to look like the Nephilim.
Yes. And my wife has told me I'm lying to people for not calling the book that. Clowns look like Nephilim. Yes, that's the truth. But the Nephilim look like clowns rolls off the tongue a bit nicer, I think.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. So let's get into how this all started unfolding for you, man, because I find this very interesting. And just to let you know and the audience know, I have a strong feeling that you're going to be back on the show, because when I did get the book today, it was probably, it was about as thick as my Bible, and it said volume one on the cover. So there's way more that you haven't even published yet. So I'm very interested in finding out what we can today and bringing you back on for more conversation for sure.
Certainly. So the first book is called The History. And it's basically a recounting of the Genesis 6 tale, where Nephilim come from a biblical contrarian Christian viewpoint. So I pretty much I agree with Gary Wayne in his depiction of what went down there. You know, and what I'm trying to do with this book and with my work is I'm trying to reach those who may not necessarily understand the biblical narrative or even want to bother to understand the biblical narrative. And I found something in The Clown which seems to appeal to that people in a way that other things just don't. And in a way, I can hook them in with The Clown. I can then have a chance to teach them about conspiracy theorist history of the biblical narrative, you know, so getting into the Book of Enoch, the Watchers, and everything your audience, I'm sure, is 100% already familiar with, and we don't need to retread today. And that's basically the first 10 chapters of the book. It's the history of the Nephilim, where they come from, why they're called what they're called, and how they existed before and after the flood, with all the theories prevalent to the whys and hows. Once that foundation is laid, the second half of the book in section two is about the history of the clown and where that comes from. And that's when we start to get into the dodgy history of the clown, how it's always been rooted in the demonic, even from its very inception with throughout the Commedia dell'arte movement of Europe, throughout the Middle Ages, all to the modern day circuses through the Shrining and the Royal Order of the Jesters as well within the hierarchy of Freemasonry and the craft. And then the back end of the book is a love letter to the psychedelic community who take dimethyltryptamine and encounter jesters while in the DMT realm. That's the world I come from. Prior to being saved in 2014, I myself was a psychedelic tripping, Eastern mystic type person who was looking for answers out, you know, within myself and, in substance abuse, basically. And, you know, coming out of that now as a born again Christian, I'm trying to reach that community and let them know that these entities you're dealing with in these realms, which you think are archetypical representations of the human psyche and the inner shadow, which needs work or something. I'm telling you, these are tangible beings separate from yourself that have a history and reason for being there. And they are not your friends. And they look like jesters because the Nephilim, which they are the disembodied spirits of, looked like clowns in physical form. So that's the first book, very quickly summarized. And you're right, it's 290 pages of reading, but if you include the references and everything else, it's actually like 331 or something stupid like that. But that's just volume one. The second book, which I've already 20% through writing and was originally going to be a part of all one big book, but I realized I already have a book here I need to publish now and then carry on a side note. The second book will be about the ancestor spirit culture worships found all over the earth, who dress like in clown-like costumes to channel spirits. And then the back half of that book will then be about the media industry, movies, music, art, and clown murderers, the fear of clowns, the multicolored collective, as I like to call them, and those people who have that spirit of the Nephilim running through them. Let's just say they have a very colorful flag to represent them. All of that stuff, you know, I kind of get into in the second book, which is The Now. So volume two will be called The Now, but volume one, which is out right now and available on Amazon, is called The History. So there's a summary of all the work, the body of work there. And today we can just get into the history of the clown, and I can prove to you that it has always been a representation of a demon, always, even before the Freemasons.
Well, yeah, I want to get into that. I don't want to lose track, and I want you to go in that direction. But there is one question that I want to. I fear that this question could steer us off track. So I just want to state that right in the beginning, so that we together teamwork, we can avoid such things happening. But you did say something about your past life that I have to ask you, out of just pure curiosity.
Yes.
Did you understand that you were dealing with entities when you were, you know, taking all the hallucinogenics and things like that? Or were you just simply thinking you're on a weird trip and it was a figment of your imagination?
See, I'm not really a hippie. I've never been the airy, fairy, loosey-goosey type, you know, or the woo-woo type of person. Even when I was doing these things, I was very logistical-minded about the situation. And I was also open to interpretation of what I was going to be dealing with. Initially, I thought it was all psychological and very Jungian in nature, archetypical, you know, representations of a collective consciousness type stuff. But then at the same time, I kind of ended up falling into the conspiracy research and waking up, shall we say, at the back end of all of this. And then I started learning about the Bible and the biblical narrative and the understanding to explain why we even have a conspiracy. So I started my YouTube channel, which is called Understanding Conspiracy, to try and get to the bottom of this whole mess. And I basically started to learn about spiritual warfare and demons. And Derek Prince was a huge influence on me in the early days, you know, about how demons operate. So I was still doing these things while learning that stuff. And I was starting to be open to the idea that, okay, these entities may not be what I thought they were, you know. But I was quite blessed that when I was doing these things and going to these places, I didn't encounter any entities at that time. I just kept going to the psychedelic realms and seeing the nature of reality and learning from it and from that psychedelic perspective, but the entities wouldn't come. And I guess in a way, at the time, I was kind of a bit disappointed by that, you know, because I didn't understand, what was I doing something wrong or what's going on here? It was only came afterwards, after being born again, did I come under heavy attack from demons, basically, and starting having visions and sleep paralysis and horrible, you know, there's a moment where I quite literally almost died and had to call in the name of Jesus to save me because darkness started to seep in from my vision and I collapsed and went paralyzed for no reason. And I started to be pulled out of my body into the DMT realm. And by this point, I'd been sober for like a year, you know, I haven't even touched the stuff or anything. But it seems like once I let go of that life and stopped being a useful vessel for demons who were living vicariously through my senses, you know, the more drugs I did, the happier they were because they got to feel that through my senses because they were happily living in my temple of God, you know, they were dwelling in there. Once I was born again and filled with the Holy Spirit and these things were kind of cast out, in hindsight, it feels like, if we can't have you, nobody can type of situation. And they tried to kill me. I feel like that's what happened. And then I started having random visions of jester entities in the DMT realm when they came for me after the fact. But when I was happily ignorant and naive of what I was doing, they didn't bother to turn up. They weren't bothering to teach me anything or show me anything or anything like that. Only after I came to Christ did I start to see these things and did they come for me. So that's kind of, you know, a part of my testimony and journey there. But I suppose that's the long answer. The short answer is, I suppose I didn't really know what I was dealing with at the time. And but then I started to learn just before I quit all that stuff. So maybe I got out just in time. Who knows?
You know, I just now had a question that then spawned a memory, and it's somewhere on my archive. I mean, we're coming up on 700 episodes. It's hard for me to remember everything, but yeah. I feel like early in the show, I had somebody talking about a clown entity that appeared before them. And the reason why that popped in my head is because my question to you was going to be, and it still is, have you come across other people describing what you saw with the jester looking entity? Are other people describing seeing these types of entities as well as you have seen? And again, I don't want to go off track what we were going to go with, but I, you know, what you're saying is fascinating. It's just spawning more questions.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, the encounters with DMT jesters is infamous in the community. It's the most prominent thing that is seen by people who take dimethyltryptamine and other psychedelics. And even people have said they've encountered these things in nightmares and dreams and sleep paralysis, you know, a big, wide, grinning, sharp tooth, pale skinned monster of some kind, you know, akin to a monstrous joker of sorts. You go to the DMT Nexus, which is like a forum full of people discussing their trip reports. And yeah, the jester encounters are extremely common. And Joe Rogan is infamous for spreading this idea and talking about DMT jesters and kind of popularizing it in the psyche of millennials, shall we say. But it's real, it's tangible, it's repeatable. You take DMT and you get jesters, you know. And it's not that they are like humans dressed in jester outfits. Their skin is that shape and color. Their heads are not, they're not wearing a jester's cap. The skull is shaped like that. It's horns, you know, it's we only have the word jester because our language is limited to describe what we're talking about and what we're seeing. So we say jester because it's the closest thing we've got, you know. But as we'll get into again, the history of this, where we even get a jester from is from the wild men of Europe, which is the quintessential European version of Nephilim. So yeah, we can get into that.
Let's do it. Let's get into it because I'll wind up asking another question that's like what's your birthday kind of thing. So let's get into the history and how this all kind of came together.
Sure. Well, my birthday is the 4th of July, first of all. And and the history.
Over here, that's a great day, man. That's a great day.
It sure is. It sure is. It's the day Will Smith beat all those aliens. So it's quite a wonderful thing. And
welcome
anyway,
to Earth.
That's right. Anyway, so the history of a clown. Yeah. So this is something I've told hundreds of times now. And hopefully I've got good enough to tell it as quickly as possible and as succinct as possible with as much information for you to go away with and look into yourself as possible now. But first of all, when I'm talking about jesters and clowns, let's get out of your mind just funny people. There's always been comedians as far back as human history since the beginning of man. There's always been people who are funny. We're not talking about funny men and comedians, okay? We're talking about a very specific design and costume style, which we call clownish today in the West. This is about aesthetics more than actions. Okay, so let's get that groundwork laid down first, because a lot of people do get too bogged down in the behavior of clowning and jesters rather than simply the way they looked, because the book is called, after all, The Nephilim Looked Like Clowns. So let's stick to what we can know. So go back in time here. We're talking about the earliest westernized image of a clown that we can understand came out of the Commedia dell'arte movements of the Middle Ages, beginning from around 500 to 1500. Roughly, and it going into the modern day. But that was its developmental period. We call it the Dark Ages, you know, when Catholicism kind of took over and was the dominant force throughout Europe. So with the collapse of Rome, there was a lot of actors out of work, should we say, the early mimics, mimes, stupidus, these performers who would often perform on stage wearing masks to mock and mimic and caricature generals and leaders and kings and things like that, you know, to make a satire. But they were never really looking like clowns necessarily. They wore costumes to look like I said, archetypical stock characters of any civilization that people can understand and grasp. But when the collapse of Rome was kind of solidified and, you know, Christendom was established, acting was kind of seen as a, like being a prostitute. It was pretty much frowned upon. And it wasn't something that you could really get away with doing publicly anymore. It became more of a private affair for the rich and affluent. This is where court jesters start to come into play. The only person who was allowed to really have a funny clown-like jester around or an actor was the king, because who's going to argue with the king, you know? It's that kind of thing. And obviously, private shows is where most of them went, but a lot of them decided to leave Rome and start traveling Europe, and they established traveling troupes of performers. And in fact, the first traveling troupes of actors to introduce female actors to the stage, just a little tidbit for you there, but they were called the Commedia dell'arte, and they came out of the tradition of Italian theatre, but they became quick improvised shows with very quick improvised stages in the town squares of any city they rolled into. It was the first traveling circus, but it was strictly improvised shows on a stage, you know. And they traveled from basically all over Europe. They went as far as Russia, you know, and as far north as Sweden and Finland and Norway, you know, any tip of Europe, they've been there and that they traveled. And they did this for 1,000 years. Quite literally 1,000 years of a development of this art form, which was a built up of a range of stock characters, as I mentioned earlier. So stock basically means it's recognizable to anywhere you go. Everyone knows who the rich man is. Everyone knows what a soldier is or the policeman. You know, everyone knows who the servant, what a servant is. And that's what these characters represented. But they were all in their own way clowns, zanies, as they were known, funny men, you know, and they all had their own routines, which was expected of the person wearing that particular mask, you know. And it was pretty set in stone for a long time what these routines came to expect it to be. But it seems odd because coming out of like 900 to 1,000 years, a random character decided to be added to the movement called Harlequin. Now, Harlequin, or Arlecchino, which is the Italian way to pronounce it, named primarily after Helikins, which is the French iteration of the wild man. So Harlequin was added as a stock character because this troop that kind of went through Europe, they had noticed something about everywhere they went. They all had this odd folk tradition called the Wild Man tradition. And they had these big festivals where they would get absolutely hammered and have a huge party dressed in monstrous, wild, big clown-looking, sharp-toothed, wide-smile, masked-wearing, hairy beast costumes. And they would have a huge party, and then they would fast. They would begin the period of Lent, you know, the 40 days of fasting. And they would just have this massive carnival festival where they basically dressed like hairy demons with huge, wide grins and smiles. And this wild man tradition, you know, they noticed this, so they decided, well, let's add a wild man to our stock character list because everyone will recognize it in Europe. And that's what they did. They introduced Harlequin, modeled after the French version called Helikins. Now, Helikins comes from a 11th century, it's like a 10th century monk describing his encounter with the wild horde. And it was this giant club-wielding beast, hairy monster thing with a bunch of demons around his ankles because he was a giant. And they basically went from village to village causing chaos. And it rode through his village in the 10th century. And he documented witnessing this wild horde. And he described and called the giant Helikins. So that's where the name comes from. And that's where Harlequin comes from. He is a model stock character of the Wild Man of Europe, which is quintessentially the European flavor of Nephilim. So there's the first proto-clown. Now, Harlequin's costume initially in these early stages was quite brutish. He wore baggy white cloth clothing, but he had multicolored patches sewn all over him, covered in tufts of hair. He wore a black mask with the nose really squashed up in an ugly manner and wrinkles all over it and an angry look over the brow. And he would have a horn, a lump sticking out of one side. And then on top of that, he would carry around this big club, which became known as the slapstick. And his character on stage was almost godlike. He could command the stage by slapping his stick on the floor, and magically the scene would change into something else. So he was beyond human capability. He had magical powers when he slapped his stick. He also was very fleet of foot, quick-footed. He could do backflips and acrobatic stunts like no other, and he was always striking these particular odd grandiose poses while he was at it in between doing these grandiose, ridiculous stunts. He was a wild card. He was a wild man in character and design. He was insane and he was edgy and rude. He would use his stick as a phallic symbol and poke it at people's backsides and like he was wafting at people's faces. You know, he was rude and crude, and that's where the comedy came from. His demonic aura, his demonic attitude, his demonic power. People thought he was hilarious and he became an instant success because everyone recognized the wild man. And you'll find a lot of these wild man traditions incorporate the phallus into it, you know, and sex and fertility and all these type of things into those rituals. So it was hardly surprising that Harlequin would also embody these type of symbolic things within his caricature of the wild man. And you can find the evidences today of the wild man tradition. It still goes on in Europe today. The most popular, biggest festival, which has its roots unchanged all the way back into Thracian culture, is the Kukri of Bulgaria. That's where you'll find the most prominent version. But even if you go from Bulgaria all the way to the other side of Europe, to Portugal, you can find the Celtic version, which is called the Kuretos. And they look extremely similar, but they're separated by a lot of land. But then they have their own style. But they all wore extremely baggy, hairy clothing with multicolors, patches, and psychedelic sequins everywhere with a big, wide-grinned, terrifying-looking demonic mask. These are the representations of demons. And then they openly will tell you that's what they're doing. A lot of them actually say when they put on the mask, they lose themselves and they become something else. They get possessed, in a sense. But then, obviously, once they let it all out and have that moment of excess, they then fast. So it's kind of not, it's okay, you know, it's all done. It's fine now, we're going to leave that behind. Now, it's odd because in Europe, we kind of, most of us in Europe believe that when you wear a scary costume, you're trying to scare away bad spirits. You know what I mean? That's kind of like Halloween kind of has that attitude that we dress like monsters to scare away the evil spirits of monsters in time for the summer or something, you know, because it's at the height of winter. But that's, we're kind of like some of the only cultures on the earth that do this. Most other cultures dress like these things to channel them, not to scare them away, but to to invite them in. And I've theorized, and I'm starting to think some trickery was afoot here. Some trickery has been afoot, and we have been duped and lied to, because there's no way dressing like a demon is going to scare a demon. They're not stupid. They're thousands of years old, you know. I think we're naive to think that that would be the case, to be honest. But that seems to be the prominent thought. Maybe it's due to the influence of Catholicism on these cultures, which, took over the pagan cultures and Catholicized them, shall we say it? Who knows? But that's the first proto-clown, Harlequin. Now, Harlequin, like I said, dressed quite demonic, acted quite demonic, was really fleet of foot. He had influence of the Italian tradition in him. He was kind of modeled a little bit after Hermes as well, who had like wings on his feet, you know, the messenger god. So Harlequin can kind of seem like he was flying on stage, like he was weightless, you know. But he also had his, Hermes has his caduceus, which is his staff, which is the slapstick. And obviously, coming out of the Dionysus tradition, where the cookery comes from the Thracian culture, Dionysus is also a fertility wild man god who stories have been told that he would basically have a roving band of merry men with him, or demons, or fauns and satyrs, who used to be humans, but since being around him for too long, transformed into wild, hairy beast creatures. And he also had his maenads as well, his naked women with him. And this is very similar to the wild horde mythology of the Helicans, which had his band of merry demons who went around from village to village terrorizing people. Instead, it seems like this tradition is ancient and represented in shape-shifting, sexually charged giants of some kind. You know, so we're talking about the Nephilim, but kind of European flavors of it all throughout. And this is who Harlequin is modeled after. Now, as the history goes on, so this is the 1600s, he's introduced. We come on out of that into the Enlightenment period and through to the Industrial Revolution. Then we're going into the 1800s. He changed drastically over this 300-year period. He became less of a demonic character, and he turned more into a doting, lovesick idiot constantly chasing after the rich man's daughter, Columbine. And that kind of became his routine in the end, you know. And his costume got a bit tighter, a bit more sequined, a bit more lithe and dandy and fancy, you know, less brutish. His mask got a bit more fancy, more like the Venetian masks. And he lost his edge. He wasn't as demonic anymore, you know. And there was kind of a void, a vacuum in the industry for that demonic edge. And you'll find in the British tradition of this comedie de l'arts, pantomime was invented in London, in Sadler's Wells Theatre and in the Royal Theatre of London. And this tradition of pantomime was getting quite big and popular, and it was the British flavour of these things. And it had the same stock characters, Pantaloon the rich man, Columbine the daughter, Harlequin the servant of the rich man, and the other servant of the rich man, which was Pedrolino. But the British version was Clown. But Clown is fundamentally Pedrolino. It's the same original character. Now, Pedrolino, the other servant of the rich man, was always the foil for Harlequin. It's kind of, Harlequin would steal the daughter of Pantaloon, the rich man, and run away. And then the rich man, with his other servant, Pedrolino, would chase after them and try and get the daughter back. And that's the comedy. That's the routine. That's the joke for an hour on stage, you know, scene after scene after scene in a Looney Tunes style chase scene, brutally attacking each other to get the daughter back, you know, and that was the comedy. That's where it arose from. But Pedrolino, fundamentally coming out of the comedie de l'art movement, was always just a boring dressed character, you know, and he was a comedian, sure, but he was more of a human idiot, you know, like he was kind of like the slow, dim-witted fool who was the antithesis to the quick-witted demonic Harlequin, you know, and that's where the comedy kind of arose. But as I said, Harlequin lost that demonic edge, and in Britain, Pedrolino became more of a edgy, demonic, lack, you know, carefree, devil-may-care character. And this was highly popularized by a actor at the time called Joseph Grimaldi, who's equated with being the father of modern clowns today, in fact. But I'll get into how this is actually a misnomer and not true at all, to be honest, and maybe a misdirection. But he basically was such a wonderful actor and so hilarious that he became synonymous with the best clowns who ever exist throughout human history. He was hilarious. People could not go and see this guy without busting a gut, you know what I mean? It was just too much for them to handle. People left there weeping in tears from the laughter type of thing. And he was edgy, he was witty, he was weird, you know? And you'll find around this time period, in the 1800s, late 1700s, there was an odd costume change for the clown as well. And Pedrolino, who the clown was modeled after, used to wear a boring white Elizabethan servant rag. He had a floppy ruffle around his neck, like a floppy, boring, cheap hat of some kind, really loose white clothing. Think of the French iteration of Pedrolino in the same tradition. He's called Pierrot, and he's the really sad clown wearing the white makeup and the pointy hat with the black pom-poms, you know. That was the French, quintessentially French version, you know, and Pedrolino was pathetic. He was always pining after Columbine. Woe is me. Why does Columbine want Harlequin and not me instead? My life is so terrible. You know, pity, pity, pity type thing. But the clown of Britain wasn't like that. He was like, I do not care about anybody but myself. I just want to drink beer and eat sausages. You know, that was the British version of the same character, Pedrolino. And people loved it. People loved how edgy he was. So they made a costume change. And suddenly Pedrolino, who for 1,000 years was dressed in boring white rags, was suddenly looking like an absolutely psychedelic, terrifying clown monster we know today, unlike anything that's ever been seen on stage before. And you have to wonder, where did this design come from? It's so out of the blue. It came out of nowhere. It's nothing like what he used to dress like. It was insane. And I have looked into it. I've got the receipts. I've done the research, and I've uncovered that there was a lot more going on behind the scenes than we first realized. So Sadler's Wells Theatre, which is where Joseph Grimaldi was working predominantly as a young up-and-comer. His father was already a famous actor in the past called the Signor from Italy, and he kind of had big shoes to fill, and he'd always been in the industry. He had always worked since a child in the theater, you know. And he actually married the daughter of the owner of that theater, Richard Hughes. And sadly for Grimaldi, young Grimaldi, she died at childbirth, and so did the child. And her last words in death were, Richard, please look after poor Joe, you know. And I think Richard Hughes kept that promise and basically went up to the showrunner who was running his theatre at that time and said to him, you need to give Grimaldi leading roles. You have to make him famous. You have to make him big so he can support himself. I promised my daughter, you know. And that's what happened. He basically became the lead clown and upstaged a classical actor who had been the lead clown forever, you know. But the odd thing is, that's when the costume change happened at the exact same time. And the person who made this choice to change the costume is somebody called Charles Dibdin, who was the showrunner who was asked this dodgy favor, you know. And this, he had just been hired, and he is the son of another man called Charles Dibdin, the same name, Charles Dibdin Sr. And it turns out Charles Dibdin Sr. is a prominent Freemason, member of the Leicestershire Lodge number, I think it's 2369. He was the most famous musician and playwright, songwriter of that time in Britain. He was a rock star. Now, Charles Dibdin Sr. is equated with writing all the music that kept the maritime sailors of the time and their morale up. He is equated with being the one who single-handedly helped Britain with their victories because of his music and what the sailors were singing and the songs he wrote. So he was considered like a big deal. He was known by everybody, including the crown, you know, and he was a Freemason through and through. Now, it seems like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, because his son, in true nepotistic fashion, was given the leadership role of one of the leading, biggest, you know, theatres in London. So it's clearly he got the job, not through his own talents necessarily, but because of the fame of his father. And also his other brother, Thomas Dibdin, had prior been given the job there as well. So it's kind of his turn, you know. And if you look into Charles Dibdin Sr., you'll find he has a weird history. He wrote a magazine called The Devil in his early years. It had about 17 episodes before it failed, 17 runs. The opening chapter of his magazine called The Devil is him talking about meeting the devil and making a deal with him. And basically saying, I was told by the devil to create this magazine, and the Brotherhood Freemasons agreed to fund it. And it was basically a magazine bashing the religious leaders of the day and the political authorities of the day, you know. And then after that failed, he became incredibly famous. So it seems like the deal with the devil was made then in some way, a true Faustian bargain of sorts. You know, I don't know what happened exactly, but that's when his fame skyrocketed and he became this famous playwright and songwriter. He was always traveling back and forth to India because his brother was a member of the East India Company, which is not technically a British military regiment. It was a private company with a very British sounding name, you know, but they were involved with basically colonizing India. And that's what they were doing. They were establishing themselves in Calcutta, primarily in the east of India. So the East India Company, his brother, Thomas Dibdin, again, a very complicated. All these names are the same. They always name their sons the same names. So his brother, Thomas Dibdin, died there. And Charles Dibdin made a song called Tom Bowling, which was so amazing that was sung by all the sailors. This really helped his fame massively. It's still sung today at the end of the proms in the UK, which is a yearly ritual classical orchestra show, you know, and at the end, they always close by playing Tom Bowling by this Charles Dibdin. So he was no joke, Charles Dibdin Sr. He was famous. He was rich, powerful. He was a media mogul of the day, you know, like we have today, powerful media moguls in the industry. Well, he was like a head of one of the major heads of the media industry, the Illuminati media industry of the 1800s. You know what I mean? He was like up there. And he, like I said, he was intimately linked with India. He was going to move there, but his boat didn't set sail due to bad weather, and he decided to change his mind last minute and stay in England. He wanted to live there. He'd traveled there so many times to see his brother, you know, and he just wanted to start a new life out there, I think. And no doubt his sons went with him on these trips. And then when you come back now to Joseph Grimaldi, brand new costume change by the son of this Freemason, Charles Dibdin Jr., and you look at the costume that he dressed him in, you'll realize something. It's identical to the costumes that were worn by the Rakshasa demons, the guardians of the temples in Thailand, in Indian culture, in Hindu culture. It's identical. Same polka dots fashioned white multicolored fractal pattern design is what he decided to dress the clown in on the stage in that time period in the 1800s. And that's where his inspiration clearly came from, his regular interval trips to India and Hindu iconography. So not only was Harlequin the first initial proto-clown jester character modeled after the European flavor of the Nephilim, which was through the Wild Man, when he was replaced by the clown as the new demonic role, the costume that the clown was then dressed in was after the Indian flavor of the Nephilim giants, which is known through the Rakshasa. And then that became the industry standard for clowning from that day forward. Joseph Grimaldi, he's said to create the makeup, the white skin fractal pattern makeup. But you realize actually it's just also the same as what these Rakshasas look like in India too. So he likely didn't come up with the makeup at all. It's just a cover story. All of it is modeled after the Rakshasa demons of India. And that became the industry standard. He was then equated as the father of modern clowns from that day. And all the clowns of and performers of that time saw the show with this new costume and were blown away and decided, you know what, we're going to start dressing like that too. And to this very day, clown costumes are still modeled after Joseph Grimaldi's original costume, which is modeled after the Rakshasa demons of India. So no matter which way you cut it, historically speaking, the clown has always been a representation of a demon. So there you go.
That is wild. That is absolutely wild. So anybody who maybe needs help making the connection still, I assume you agree with me on this, is that, you know, if the clowns look like demons, well, where do the Nephilim come in? And that's because, like you said earlier, the Book of Enoch, it clearly shows and states how the demons are the spirits of the dead Nephilim. So yes. It's this domino effect of representation that carries us from the beginning to now where we are in today's world. And I know you said you're writing a book about the current times, which I'm very excited for you to come out with already. But you really did lay a great picture here as to how this has come into modern times. And I'm assuming the answer is no, but it doesn't seem like it's an accident that we have Harley Quinn and the Joker as a character duo in DC comic books that are in love with each other and what many people would say act demonic in the way they represent these characters in these movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's tongue-in-cheek humor to the truth. They're both representations of demons to begin with. They're one of the both psychopaths in this fictional reality created by likely people who are in the know to what these symbols actually represent. You know, a clown is not just a funny man. It's a representation of the Nephilim. And I think there are people in the industry who know this intimately and have been using this, rubbing it in our face for a long time. Do you know, like... Once you discover the symbols, you can't stop seeing them type of situation. When you start waking up and you see the signs and symbols in all the media and you realize it was there the whole time. Why didn't I see it? Now I've told you this, you're going to see it everywhere. You are going to see the clown in everything, hidden everywhere. And it's always been there and it's always represented the Nephilim. And like I said, it's to wear the costume of something actually is quite a serious spiritual practice. Especially to most other cultures around the world, we just don't know that in the West. We are naive to the spiritual implications of dressing certain ways. A costume to us is just a bit of fun for Halloween. A costume to, let's say, the Fayum of India is a means to get in touch with the primordial gods of the ancient spirits in order to get information and power from them. You know, it's actually and sacrifice to them while you're at it, you know. In fact, the Indian Thayum, who do dress in this very clownish, wild features, one member of the tribe does this, and all the other villagers come around him and give him things like live chickens, and the person who's possessed by the demon will bite the head off that chicken and drink its blood to appease the demon within him, because that's what the demon wants. And then once the sacrifice has been given through the vessel, the person embodying the demon, they get knowledge from it, they talk to it, they ask it questions, and the channeler lets the demon speak through him to answer these things. You know, that it's actually not hidden at all in most of these other cultures that don't have Jesus Christ or Christianity, because they have no fear that one of these people are randomly going to stand up and cast them away in the name of Christ, because they're not religious in that sense, in a Christian sense, you know. But because the West is a highly Christianized nation, it has to be hidden. They have to keep it a cult. They can't let people know that that's what's going on. So the Nephilim hide in our culture through the clown. And if you dress like a clown, you are doing the same spiritual practice these other cultures who know what they're doing are doing. You just don't know it. You're just ignorant of that. And ignorance of the spiritual laws does not make you immune to the spiritual laws, unfortunately.
You know, what you just said is something that I was going to bring up, and I'm glad you brought it up. You know, I can only imagine the amount of people who have told you off for saying the things that you're saying because they enjoy dressing up as a clown for Halloween, or they think it's cute dressing their kids up for Halloween and making it a clown. And here you are telling them that they're basically creating their children to be a vessel for demons one night a year. I mean, am I right or am I right with the amount of people who probably reached out to you pissed off?
Well, surprisingly, I'm not saying that hasn't happened, but it's a lot less than you would think.
Really?
I've more had people who idolize clowns themselves and perhaps have a lot of Joker iconography or love Harlequin from the DC universe, for example, get upset and furious with me saying it's just a cartoon character. It's nothing. It's not that serious, you know, and I love it and I love what it represents. And I'm kind of like, look, the history is the history. It is what it is. I'm not trying to say you're a bad person for liking clowns or necessarily, but just be careful, be aware of what these things actually are, you know? And I think it's kind of cognitive dissonance at the start. And I get it. It sounds silly. Clowns are something fun for the kids, right? That's what they've always been to us. And that's how we're supposed to take it. Yeah. That's the point. You're supposed to take it as something fun for the kids because it's an occult symbol. That's the exoteric thing they want you to take away from a clown. But esoterically, it's a representation of demons and is a tool for channeling demons. And it's used by the industry. The secret of the music industry isn't to have talent, you know, or to be able to sing. It's just dress as much as you can like a psychedelic fractal clown monster, and you will be elevated. The people who run the industry will put you in the spotlight because they want more people idolizing you and mimicking the way you look. Because the more people they can get dressing that way, the more channels they open. And that's what we're seeing happen today in the West. The rise of clownish aesthetics, even in fashion, is on the rise for that very reason. They're playing with us and we don't realize it. Just at the beginning of 2023, you know, Elle magazine and all the catwalks in France and high fashion were dressing like clowns. Clown core aesthetics were in and high fashion. and expect it to come into the outlet stores in 2024 near you. Obviously, it won't look as outrageous as what they were wearing on the catwalks, but we'll get a watered down version of that, and Harlequin sequin designs will start coming in into your local, Selfridges or whatever you have over there, you know, a JCPenney or something like that. You know, they'll end up on the rack and people will start dressing in clownish features as a legitimate fashion choice because everyone else is doing it. It won't be seen as odd, and they're normalizing it as time goes on. And I'm not joking. Go and check that out. That happened. And there's a huge movement in TikTok from mainly Gen Z and young millennials, which is called clowncore aesthetic, where they are legitimately dressing like clowns and walking down the street as a real fashion choice, not ironically, you know. And there's like an underground subculture growing because of that. And wow. You have to wonder, in hindsight, to this information, what's really going on there? What's the real agenda? Why do in the West and in Canada, and I don't know if you do it in America or not, but they have something called Red Nose Day, where every year there's this yearly ritual put on by the media where everybody dresses like a clown and puts on a big red nose, you know, and it's kind of, you have to think about this now in hindsight to this. Is that a yearly invocation ritual to strengthen? And it's always for the kids, right? It's to raise money for dying children in Africa or something. It's comic relief because clowns are just something funny and fun for the kids. You look at black and white photos of children around the early clowns. They are screaming with fear, with tears streaming down their face, while the parents are stood next to them laughing, like, oh, how laughing. Cute. And it's kind of like, those kids don't like those things. Kids have a natural aversion to clowns. It's like one in like 20 children that actually like clowns. The studies have been done. They were never for kids. That's just the cover story, you know. Why do the Shriners all have a clown sect? Were they dressed like clowns to entertain dying children in their hospitals? I don't think so. You know, it's because it represents the things they're in communion with, that they're working with in the hierarchy of the Luciferian agenda. They are the secret societies are the physical foot soldiers for the spiritual leaders. And just below the angels are the Nephilim in the spirit world. Then just below the Nephilim in the physical world are the secret societies. They answer to them. They channel them. And they work intimately with them. And now they can publicly dress like them, go to a dying child in a hospital, scare the crap out of them, and feed off that energy through them channeling the spirit. It's all works in tandem and in cycle. What does a Middle Eastern themed secret society, what business do they have dressing like a Western clown? It makes no sense until you incorporate this information here. Why? Yeah. One step above shrining. You're a Freemason, then you can be a Shriner, which is considered higher than Freemasonry. And then why, by invite only, is the highest honor for Shriners to become a jester? Why? A jester of all things. It's just odd, isn't it? Why is that the hierarchical pinnacle peak of going through the craft? You get to the top, you're finally a jester. What? Doesn't make any sense until you start thinking about this in hindsight, you know? Okay, yeah. So yeah, because it was always a representation of the demons that they're in cahoots with, that they are channeling and working intimately with. You know, they let the demon in, and the deal is they get something in return. They get power, insight, they can travel or astral travel or read people's minds or have the strength of 10 men or get cut and not bleed. I don't know, but these are what the tribes in Africa are doing when they channel theirs. I know Africa's a huge continent with many countries and cultures, but you'll find a running theme throughout many of these countries and cultures that they do have this practice of dressing like their ancestors for power, to gain something, which is useful for warring tribes. You know, it's useful not to have to deal with spears and being cut and bleeding to death when you're at war with a neighboring tribe. You know, it's these type of things, and this practice is ancient, and it's still being done today in the West. It's just hidden under the veneer of fun for the kids. Wow. You look at the development of the circus, which is the home of the clown, right? Well, that came out of the expansionist movement into the West. Coming out of the theaters, the clown became the main staple of any circus to entertain the crowd in between scene changes. You know, the comedy, the clown would do a bit of a comedy routine, and then they'd change stuff in the background for the next feats, you know. But you realize that a circus, through and through, is an industry owned by secret societies and Freemasons and rich businessmen. P.T. Barnum, the guy who's equated with being the father of modern circuses in America, he invented the three-ring circus. Is it no coincidence that three interlocking rings is the logo for the Odd Fellows, which is another offshoot of secret societies and Freemasonry, which he was a member, you know? And members of the Odd Fellows are all presidents and kings and
actors. Charlie Chaplin is a member of the Oddfellows, and so is King George V. Like, what an odd mix of people, you know? And yeah. it makes you wonder, okay, so are the members of the Oddfellows, are they all actors? And they all pretend to play somebody on the main stage of the world, like a king or a leader or something. And they're all just a part of the script, you know? And that's where we put the Actors Guild over there in the Oddfellows, which P.T. Barnum, Phineas Taylor Barnum, was a member, who basically introduced the freak show to the menagerie of animals with Bailey. And created the circus as you know it today in America. It's always been a Freemason affair. Even today, Shriners own pretty much all American circuses. And it's because these are giant invocation rituals. The circus is not just a bit of fun for the family. Like, this is where it gets really weird. The circus is quite literally a model of Freemasonic rituals that you see in lodges, just on a bigger scale. So the ringleader of a circus, the black top hat wearing, cane wielding orchestrator of the clowns, is a representation of King Solomon. So in a Freemason lodge, the only person who's allowed to wear a black top hat is the leader of the lodge, the Grand Worshipful Grand Master. And they'll tell you this publicly. You can go and search for it. The hat represents the crown of Solomon. Now, what did Solomon do? He used a ring, the ringmaster, to orchestrate the demons to build his temple. So the ringmaster of a circus is controlling the clowns, the demons, which they represent, within the ritual of a circus performance. He is the ringleader. He is King Solomon. He is the Lord of the Ring. He is the orchestrator of the ritual. He is in control of the clowns. It's Solomon in control of the demons. It's an analogous story. It's the same thing. And also, never mind the fact that a fun fair with flashing lights and spinning wheels and psychedelic colors is a perfect representation of the psychedelic DMT realm where these jesters now reside as well. It's all tongue-in-cheek references to the spiritual truth of the matter, and circuses are quite literally a representation of Freemasonic ritual. In the 1800s, 10 huge circuses all got together, all of them run by Freemasons. Every last one of them, all the Ringling Brothers, all run by Freemasons, all of them are Freemasons. Even the father was a Freemason. They all got together and they put on a huge show called King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And it was massive. It traveled all over America. It had animals galore. It had like 10 rings. It was just insane. It was mad. They had thousands of actors. All the costumes were made by the Anderson Arms Company, a company that would provide costumes for Freemason lodges for their own rituals, made all the costumes for this show. All the artwork was made by Belossi Carriffy, I think the Caralfi, who was a London Freemason who designed a lot of the artwork for the temples all throughout Freemasonry. Everything was Freemason in-house created for this show called King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, because they idolized Solomon in Freemasonry. They constantly tried to recreate his temple, and they've just created this huge spectacle which people come and pay for, involving clowns and animals and this ringleader, which is quite literally inviting the public to come in on a Freemasonic ritual and take part in the invocation ritual. But the public don't know that. They think it's a fun for the family. But any initiated would go to these shows and go, this is nuts. I'm used to seeing this on a tiny scale in my little backwater lodge. Now I'm looking at this huge grand spectacle and it's amazing. And they understand all the symbolism and the narrative that's going on. But the public aren't supposed to know because it's an occulted symbol. So yeah, the clown has always represented the demon, and the ringleader of a circus is the Lord of the Ring, King Solomon, who controlled demons in the ring. He's the ringmaster. It's always been that way. We've just figured it out now, should we say.
Well, you're figuring it out and sharing with us. This is fascinating. There's so many things that you're saying that just kind of popping in my head. I mean, the circus, I remember when I was a kid, I went to a circus. I've only been to the circus once when I was a kid, and it terrified me. It terrified me. And given this context, it would make sense because it was like this massive ritual. And even in movies, again, like I got to go back and watch these Batman movies because, you know, we talked about the Joker, Harley Quinn. And even in, I believe it was one of the Batman movies, maybe multiple, I remember there being a huge circus and it being this like this dark themed thing. I've never ever considered this historical value connected to clowns, and then even into modern days, like in our own, I mean, literally there's there's probably hours of content that you could share where you're talking about just Hollywood itself, like the Hunger Games and the way they dressed it in the majestic city, whatever it was called in the movie, The Hunger Games. I mean, this is even down to real life stuff. You're talking about fashion. I've people that listen to the show, they know I love basketball, and my favorite team is the Philadelphia 76ers. They just drafted a kid who paints his fingernails like crazy and is on TikTok dancing around and stuff. And it's kind of, you know, I'm an old guy. Like it's not my vibe. Like I don't understand it, you know, but the kids do that these days. And, but that thought paired with, another famous player who's retired now, his name's Dwayne Wade. He's been painting his fingers and stuff and seeming like he's getting ready to start dressing up like a clown himself. And I'm starting to wonder, like, there's these little things. And I'm not saying that, you know, like it's the fingernail painting that's giving it away. I'm just saying, like, it's this idea of painting and dressing and changing. It's very interesting. I find it very fascinating. Listen, before we get out of here, I want you to tell people where they can find more stuff about what you've been researching. Obviously the book, but your YouTube channel, let them know where they can find you, because I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of people that are chomping at the bit to get their hands on that first volume.
Yeah. So you can get the book on Amazon. I've got a copy here. The Nephilim Look Like Clowns. Like I said, it's a relatively decent read, but I've written it in a way that's very easy to understand. It's like I'm having a conversation with you. The reviews have come in and people seem to like it for that reason. So it's an easy read, but it's full of information. It's completely referenced. I've got the receipts for everything I've said. I'm not just making this up and talking out of my ass, as a lot of people have imagined I'm doing. This can be backed up by history. This is the truth. It's a symbol, you know, and it's been exposed, shall we say. And yeah, you can find most of my work on YouTube. I am on other platforms, but YouTube is the place to find me for understanding conspiracy. And if you go onto that channel, you can go to my playlist section. There's a playlist called The Nephilim Look Like Clowns, which does span over 8 years. What I've talked about today maybe just covers a third of all the research on this. This gets way deeper. This gets nuts, all right? And in that series, with visuals to back it up, you can find all the information I've shared today with the images and so much more. So go and check that out. I even touch on all the modern day stuff, the movies, the music, and all that type of thing as well as the ancestor spirit worship cultures and individual cultures who do their own thing and why they do it and the costumes they wear and how they were also representing the Nephilim. It's all there to back it up on YouTube in that 44 episode series. I've not added any more episodes in a while because I've been focused on the book publishing, but obviously more will come in the future if you subscribe to my channel. But I am a conspiracy theorist first and foremost. I'm not a one-trick pony. I talk about a lot of things on my channel. I touch many topics, and I'm also known for the guys talking about the millennial kingdom and the millennial reign, and perhaps it maybe has already happened. So that's another whole can of worms we're not going to talk about today. But if you want to know more about the clowns, go to my YouTube channel, go to the playlist. If you want to buy the book, you can get it on Amazon. Just search The Nephilim Look Like Clowns.
Man, I appreciate you being here. When I was a kid, they didn't let me do Halloween. And when I was in first grade, I was the only kid that wasn't dressing up for Halloween. And they're doing this parade around the school or something. And one of the teachers had an extra costume and they put me in this costume against my parents' wishes, just so that I wouldn't be left out. That costume was a clown. And now I'm wondering, is that what started all this for me in my life? Is this what brought me here? Is that I dressed like a clown as a child, and ever since then I was marked to be confronting and facing these ancient Nephilim in current days. Listen, Paul, I am blown away by this stuff that you just talked about, and I got to have you back, man. I got to have you back. This has been absolutely fantastic. And we will explore more of this topic next time. But also next time, I want to explore some of your other tricks. You know, you're not a one trick pony. Let's explore some of the other things, man. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's the show, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, please share the show with your friends. I don't care where or how you share the show. Just share the show. If you enjoyed it, that's the best thing you can do to help the show grow. We'll go to 1 million subscribers on YouTube. I give it about 3 years. Let's make it 2, actually. 2 years. We'll be at 1 million subscribers, and all because you guys help us get there. Thanks for everything you guys do for the channel and the show. And until next Tuesday, stay safe, take care, and remember, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. Bye.
I am alone, I am so cold, a rose in a cage. My petals are thrown into the wind, I'm left with no face. Cause when I scream, please hear my pain. Cause when I'm gone, I have no name. I am alone, I am so cold, a rose in a cage. My petals are thrown into the wind, I'm left with no face. Cause when I scream, please hear my pain. Cause when I'm gone, I have no name. I'm feeling so lost in this cage, I don't know who to blame. They use me when they wanna play. I'm just a puppet on the stage. I wonder if anyone outside can hear me. Maybe when the chalk is outlined sincerely. Kill me so I can fade away. Feel me. You know what you gave away. I am alone, I am so cold, a rose in a cage. Thrown into the wind, I'm left with no face. Cause when I scream, please hear my pain. Cause when I'm gone, I have no name. I am alone, I am so cold, a rose in a cage. My petals are thrown into the wind, I'm left with no face. Cause when I scream, please hear my pain. Cause when I'm gone, I have no name.
These things I did not choose, they choose them for me.
In a cage, my petals are thrown into the wind, I'm left with no face. Cause when I scream, please hear my pain. Cause when